Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning. This episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of racism, torture, murder, violence, war, assault, genocide, child abuse, sexual assault, and suicide.
It's hard to start a revolution. Even harder to continue it. And hardest of all, to win it. It's only afterwards, when we have won, that the true difficulties begin. La Battaglia di Algeri, a film written by Sadi Yassif, 1966. What would you be willing to do to free your country? Would you be willing to endure obscene torture? Could you forsake your life for an existence marred by privation and hunger? Would you be able to go so far as to plant a bomb in a crowded cafe to avenge your fallen comrades, even when you knew it would kill and maim innocent people? Three women: Zora Driff, Jamila Buhayrid, and Samia Lakhdari would have to contemplate their answers to these heavy questions. But in the end, all accepted their assignment. They were not the first bombers in Algiers. That distinction belonged to the ultra-conservative Pied Noir, who had murdered 70 Algerian men, women, and children with a bomb which had been haphazardly placed in the middle of the Kasbah. This did not include the tens of thousands of other innocent Algerians who died throughout the country as a result of French policy. The French leveled entire villages with napalm, shot suspected FLN members, and tortured hundreds of thousands of people. How did things get to this point? And why did France cling so desperately to the last vestiges of their quote-unquote empire? When hostilities began on All Saints' Day in 1954, few believed that these insurrections would be the prelude to an 8-year-long war. It did not have to be this way. At the start of hostilities, the FLN made a point to abstain from killing French civilians. This would remain the rule for some time. This did not mean French civilians were not accidentally made casualties. Infamously, the newlywed couple, Guy and Jeanine Monnerot, were the first two French civilian casualties. Supposedly, they found themselves on the wrong bus at the wrong time. And during a shootout between French yes-men and FLN militants, the two were accidentally shot. Guy bled out before help could arrive, but Jeanine survived the ordeal. The Monnerot's suffering was used as a tool by French propaganda to showcase how dastardly the FLN members were. The reality is that French atrocities were the main reason behind the FLN's eventual targeting of French civilians. At first, the objective of the FLN was to capture French military installations throughout the country. Arsenals, barracks, and military storage yards were the main targets. Hit-and-run tactics were utilized in all offensive operations, and all efforts were made to avoid frontal attacks. In spite of their planning, All Saints Day was a debacle for the FLN. One rebel cell attacked too early and nearly gave away the entire revolution. All major objectives, including the radio stations and the gasworks, remained in French hands. All the FLN had to show for their efforts were casualties, a handful of burned bridges, and several captured weapons of various caliber. In Kabylia in the Aurès Mountains, the rebels were mildly successful. Power lines and telegraph wires were cut, and French fields and infrastructure were destroyed. The reaction to this was swift and drastic. Even the Communist Party of Algeria decried the quote-unquote All Saints tragedy, calling the FLN revolutionaries provocateurs and sowers of panic. On November 12th, Pierre Mendès France, the Prime Minister of France, said, quote, "One does not compromise when it comes to defending the internal peace of the nation, the unity and integrity of the Republic. The Algerian departments are part of the French Republic. They have been French for a long time, and they are irrevocably French. Between them and metropolitan France, there can be no conceivable secession. Never will any French government or parliament, whatever may be their particularistic tendencies, yield on this fundamental principle. Several deputies have made comparisons between French policy in Algeria and Tunisia. I declare no parallel is more erroneous, that no comparison is false or more dangerous. Here is France." Unquote. The Minister of the Interior and future Prime Minister of the country, François Mitterrand, was more bellicose than Mendès France. He said, quote, "The only negotiation is war." Unquote. In Algeria, the Pied Noir legislature granted the government extrajudicial powers to both the Algerian police and the local military leaders. The ultras blamed Mendès France, as well as his policy of reconciliation with other Maghrebi nations, for the outbreak of violence in Algeria. Privately, Mendès France wanted to introduce an Algerian New Deal, which would have granted full citizenship to all Algerians. However, with the start of the Algerian War, Mendès France was trapped. He had to continue to foster relations with the Pied Noir or risk his unstable coalition collapsing. French efforts to end the rebellion were off to a slow start. French forces had failed to learn their lesson from the NBN Fu. They arrived on the Algerian beaches with tanks and troop carriers, both of which were basically useless once off-road. Jean Servier, a French officer on the ground, speculated, quote, "If, in 1830, the French Expeditionary Force had had tanks, they wouldn't have gotten beyond the beach at Sidi Farouk." Unquote. The French army had no mules, no horses, and only a single helicopter. The first French reinforcements were units dispatched from the regular army. They were sent deep into the regions in which the rebellion had been most successful. This included the Aurès Mountains and Kabylia. Many French soldiers were struck by the abject poverty in these places. Hunger and desperation were etched on the faces of every person they met. Few prisoners were taken by either side. Algerians considered quote-unquote loyal to the French regime were targeted often. Algerian policemen and civil servants who were in the employ of France were usually found with their throats slit by the FLN. When the French were unable to track the FLN down, they often resorted to terror tactics, employing quote-unquote collective punishment against the entire population of towns and villages in which FLN attacks occurred. Many areas, including Ikmal, were leveled by the French Air Force. After each French bombing, the FLN unsurprisingly gained a steady stream of fresh recruits. The French were very successful in taking out the leadership of the FLN. Numerous local and national leaders were either killed, died mysteriously while in French custody, or were kidnapped and arrested by the French. However, France failed to acknowledge the regenerative quality of the Algerian Revolution. Whenever one leader was removed, a more dynamic leader took their place. This was especially true in places like Algiers. Following the destruction of the local rebel cell, a new one sprang up in its place. This process still took time, and in the interim, the French believed the rebellion had sputtered out before it began. As 1954 melted into 1955, the FLN found themselves against the ropes. The arrival of elite French paratroopers whittled the strength of the FLN down to just 350 combatants. Comparatively, French forces numbered almost 160,000. Pierre Lhuillier was in the thick of the fighting. He kept an extensive diary, which he published after his service. In it, he writes of a standard engagement between French paratroopers and the FLN, saying, quote, "At 1 o'clock, with no warning, violent shooting breaks out, followed by bursts of automatic rifle fire. The Barrettes Blues of the 18th RCP have made contact with a group of outlaws in front of us. Ahead of us, a rebel hidden in a tree opens fire. No one can see him. In less than a minute, he has mortally wounded two of our lead riflemen. He is single-handedly holding up the whole company, which has stopped dumbfounded, deployed in line. Meanwhile, the other rebels, though already encircled, have been taking position behind boulders. Shooting begins over the bodies of our two comrades, whom we cannot yet reach. Beneath one of them, a dark stain slowly spreads. It is impossible to locate anyone. The sound of the shots, our only clue. I fire bursts of two or three shots at the objective a lieutenant has just pointed out to me. From the other side, someone who perhaps does not see me either, but who hears me, is just as conscientiously firing at me. I reflect he may well get me in the end, if only by luck. Perhaps that is really all war is, trying to kill someone without knowing whom or why, and being killed the same way. Who would ever be willing to die if he knew why?" Unquote. In early 1955, Mendès France's government fell, but not before he appointed Jacques Soustelle as the new Governor General of Algeria. Soustelle was an ardent anti-fascist, an expert in Mayan and Aztec culture, and an ally of the former Prime Minister de Gaulle. He promised reform in all major aspects of Algerian life. Among other things, he wanted to do away with the ridiculous electoral system in Algeria, vastly increase the number of native Algerians who were able to vote, and make Arabic a recognized language alongside French. Finally, and most importantly, he created the SAS, or the Sections Administratives Specialises. These sections were set up all across the country and run by French officers who oversaw the administration of remote Algerian towns. Some of the sections became quote-unquote intelligence centers in which torture was used to gain information. On the whole, however, the SAS was one of the more effective French reforms, and for that reason, members of the SAS were targeted more often than any other members of the French administration. This was all a part of a larger strategy devised by the FLN to completely remove any penchant toward liberal compromise in Algerians. Many other revolutionary movements throughout history have fallen victim to internal decay because they allowed compromise with their oppressor. But Algerians remained stalwart in their collective goal of national independence. Peace negotiations with France would come later. In late August of 1955, the interdiction against killing French civilians was lifted by the FLN. The leadership of the group fell into the hands of new, more militant individuals, like Youssef Zegout, who believed French civilians should pay the same price Algerian civilians had paid. Zygut said, quote, "To colonialism's policy of collective repression, we must reply with collective reprisals against the Europeans, military and civil, who are all united in the crimes committed against our people. For them, no pity, no quarter." Unquote. Zygut, who was in charge of Wilaya 1, declared August 20th to be the start of a true quote-unquote people's revolt. The Algerian populations of the harbor town of Philippeville and the surrounding area would rise up in their thousands and kill any Europeans they could find. Compelled by FLN militants amongst them, Algerians armed with, quote, "hunting guns, scythes, bill hooks, shovels with sharpened edges, and knives," unquote, went into a frenzy. Algerians went house to house, killing any Europeans they could find. Alastair Horn says, quote, "In houses literally awash with blood, European mothers were found with their throats slit and bellies slashed open by billhooks. Infants had their brains dashed out against the wall." Unquote. In total, 123 European men, women, and children were killed in the initial FLN-inspired attack. The French response was immediate, and it was exactly what the FLN wanted. French police, army, and paratrooper units were dispatched, and they began a ruthless massacre of any and all quote-unquote Arabs they could find. Pierre Lulet was a part of the initial waves of French reinforcements. He said, quote, "We opened fire into the thick of them, at random. Then as we moved on and found more bodies, our company commanders finally gave us the order to shoot down every Arab we met. You should have seen the result. For 2 hours, all we heard was automatic rifles spitting fire into the crowd. Apart from a dozen stragglers, weapons in hand, whom we shot down, there were at least 150 dead. At midday, fresh orders. Take prisoners. By 7 o'clock, we had several hundred. We didn't get them anything to eat. We had only 2 days' rations on hand. Anyway, they had to die. If we'd kept them too long, the Europeans who escaped the massacre would never have forgiven us. They were already angry enough at our getting there too late. They would have come and killed them themselves. At 6 o'clock the next morning, all the regiment's automatic rifles and machine guns were lined up in front of this mass of prisoners. They started to yell, but we opened fire. 10 minutes later, it was over. There were so many of them that they had to be buried with bulldozers." Unquote. In total, as many as 12,000 Algerians died in the French reprisals, which followed the murders in Philippeville. The political reaction to Philippeville was also immediate. Soustelle doubled down on the need to quote-unquote crush the rebels. His total available manpower swelled to over 160,000, while moderate Algerians were unilaterally shocked by France's policy of quote-unquote collective punishment. It was the wedge the FLN had been looking for. Albert Camus was equally shocked by both Algerian and French acts. He tried to get both sides to agree to a civil truce. As the name implies, it was an agreement to cease killings and executions against Algerian and French civilians alike. Camus got some backing from the few liberals who remained in Algeria, but his civil truce organization was infiltrated by the FLN and used to spread its message. Deeply upset at being quote-unquote used, Camus would only write about Algeria once more before his death in a car accident. Throughout 1955, Ben Bella was abroad, attempting to internationalize the plight of his native land. He was tracked by French intelligence agencies, like the secretive Maison Rouge. They attempted to assassinate him several times, but Ben Bella survived every attempt made. The Algerian cause for independence had several friends abroad. Notably, the other Maghrebi nations of Tunisia and Morocco showed intense interest in assisting them. Additionally, countries in the global south attempted to have the quote-unquote Algerian question brought before the new United Nations in the hopes of gaining recognition of Algerian nationhood. Besides this, lip service was paid to Algeria by President Nasser of Egypt, who promoted the Algerian cause in his own state propaganda, but did little else to assist the rebellion, save for a handful of token weapon deliveries. In general, the biggest thorn in the side of French domination of the FLN was Tunisia. The Tunisian president, Habib Bourguiba, was incredibly sympathetic to the FLN. He gave the organization rights of sanctuary, but continued to seek favor with the Western powers. Bourguiba played a dangerous game, as allowing Algerian freedom fighters into his country ran the risk of destabilizing his new nation. In Algeria, the new leaders of the movement were making their presence felt. Amongst them was Ramdane Abane, a man of Kabylie descent, who has often been described as the, quote, Robespierre of the FLN, unquote. He had already served time in a French jail for his role in the Sétif massacre. During that time, he read about politics voraciously, and upon his release in 1955, immediately joined the rebellion. He believed violence was the only language the colonizer would or could understand. His favorite saying, "One corpse in a jacket is always worth more than 20 in uniform." He believed Algeria's main enemies were, quote, the traitors and cowards, unquote, who sided with France. It became a rite of passage for FLN initiatives to kill those deemed traitors. If no traitors were on hand, French policemen and officials would be targeted in their stead. In both categories, the FLN was brutally effective. Over the course of 2.5 years of war, over 7,000 Algerians and Europeans were killed. In a great revolutionary irony, Abane himself would be executed by FLN hit squads in 1957 because he had attained too much power. The French often accused communist and socialist states of actively supporting the Algerian Revolution. The reality of the situation is more complicated. At first, communist states did not support the FLN. As a result, the Algerian National Movement did not trust the Algerian Communist Party, resulting in the party's eventual dissolution. Although the party leadership could not be trusted, individual communists in Algeria were instrumental in the revolution's success. Amongst them was the Pied Noir, Henri Maillot. When he was called up to serve, he deserted his post and took a large number of weapons and explosives with him. Maillot then joined the Maquis Rouge, a communist-oriented rebel cell. He was killed in a French ambush, but the weapons he took would come in handy soon. Besides Maillot, another European communist, Fernand Evetan, was apprehended while planting a bomb in a French gasworks. He was subsequently guillotined, but both are remembered as, quote, martyrs of the Algerian nation today. Other pro-FLN Europeans aided the rebellion as well. Pierre Chollet was a surgeon who befriended Abane and other FLN leaders. When Abane asked Chollet why he would fight with the revolutionaries, Chollet said to Abane, quote, "We are Algerians like you. Our soil, our country is Algeria. We shall defend it with you. We are of the FLN." Unquote. Chollet's house acted as a safe house for many revolutionaries. After his cover was blown in 1958, he was forced into exile in Tunisia, where he spent the rest of the war operating on young wounded militants. Following the war, he and his wife would choose Algerian citizenship. Their progeny still live there to this day. Frantz Fanon, the Pan-Caribbean revolutionary, was also at the forefront of supporting the Algerian cause until his death from leukemia in 1961. André Mandouze, a college professor, attempted to act as an intermediary between French diplomats and the revolutionaries. Finally, the Jewish population of Algeria was largely pro-FLN. Many Jewish city dwellers acted as double agents, infiltrating French intelligence. Politically, the FLN was consolidating itself. Besides absorbing the former members of the Communist Party, they would gain the allegiance of Ferhat Abbas and his liberals. Abbas had attempted time and again to oppose, quote, the radical FLN, unquote. He had come to realize that this was pointless, and liberation from France could only be achieved via the barrel of a gun. In early 1956, he said, quote, "My party and I have thrown our entire support into the cause defended by the FLN. My role today is to stand aside for the chiefs of the armed resistance. The methods I have upheld for the last 15 years, cooperation, discussion, persuasion, have shown themselves to be ineffective. This I recognize." Unquote. The FLN was now a mass movement composed of people who believed in varying political ideologies, all trying to accomplish one goal, Algerian liberation. In early 1956, Guy Moyet became the new French prime minister. His stint in office would last 16 months, which is considered a very long time for post-World War II French governments. Moyet, who described himself as a socialist, escalated the war, attempted to reform the situation in Algeria, and began actively employing local Algerians in the defense of their towns and villages. By mid-1956, French troops numbered over 500,000. Many of them were Algerians loyal to France. The United States answered the call from their allies and supplied the French military with over 300 helicopters. All this effort failed to make a serious difference in Algeria and amongst the revolutionaries. By late 1956, Moyet was attempting to reach a diplomatic solution with the FLN, but the FLN refused to bend, and the war continued. Moyet's government began the policy of regroupment of populations. As the name implies, French officials removed entire populations from their towns and villages and regrouped them into open-air concentration camps. As many as 2.5 million Algerians were forcibly displaced by French authorities. That's almost a third of the entire population. Many died during the journey or as a result of disease and overcrowding. This policy was carried out by French officers who were newly arrived from Indochina. They had also studied Mao, and they wanted to ensure that the FLN would get no support from the people. They also created intelligence gathering centers, which specialized in torture and making people disappear. In addition to these barbaric and genocidal missions, French intelligence was busy actively targeting FLN leadership with acts of terror. In March, they used a booby-trapped radio to kill Ben Boulade, one of the Nuit Historiques. His killing aroused suspicions of treachery within the FLN, which was already fracturing. The pro-Ben Bella, or exterior faction, and the pro-Abane, or interior faction, were taking form. On August 20th, 1956, the first anniversary of the killings in Philippsville, the leaders of the FLN met at Soummam for a conference. The representatives at the conference wanted to prevent anyone from gaining too much power, reform the political situation, and restructure the military hierarchy. For example, they agreed that no one should possess a rank higher than colonel. They also agreed to do away with the nine-man CRUA and replace it with the Conseil National de la Révolution Algérienne, or the CNRA, which was composed of 36 delegates from all across the country. Most importantly, the conference agreed that defeating France by any means was more important than the international perception of the struggle. This ensured more power was placed into the hands of military leaders like Abane and Krim. That same year, special powers were granted to the Armed Forces and Justice Departments of Algeria. During a secret cabinet meeting, François Mitterrand approved the use of the death sentence by guillotine. Throughout the year, dozens of Algerians were executed in this fashion. Hamida Zabana and Abdelkader Farad, two FLN assassins, were killed in this manner. The FLN was furious at the executions, and they promised they would kill 100 Europeans as retribution for each of them. On June 19th, the two were executed, and Algeria exploded into violence. In 10 days, almost 50 European civilians were killed, while Pied Noir ultras placed a bomb which killed 70 Algerians. This cascade of violence was the catalyst for the battle for Algiers. Executions of Algerians did not end with the change of government, or even the fall of the Republic and the rise of President de Gaulle. They continued until the final days of the war. Caye Moyet was doing all he could to keep Algeria. He continued the controversial policy of employing conscripts to fight in Algeria. At the same time, he refused to acknowledge that what was happening in Algeria was indeed a war. Instead, he and all future French governments claimed it was merely a, quote, internal police action, since Algeria was, quote, a part of France, unquote. Due to this, they refused to give out France's highest military honor, the Croix de Guerre, to soldiers who had fought and died in Algerian battlefields. In 1956, the French government began awarding the North African Commemorative Medal to those who exhibited bravery during the fighting in Algeria. One of these controversial conscript units was the 9th Regiment de Infanterie Coloniale Battalion, which arrived in Algeria in early May of 1956. Ali Khodja of the FLN and his rebel cell opposed them. Khodja had the allegiance of the vast majority of the local villagers in the region. They acted as his eyes and ears. In Amal, a 21-man patrol was ambushed by the FLN and completely wiped out. Khodja and his rebels became the main targets of an intense French dragnet. 5 days after the Palestro massacre, Khodja's band was hunted down and annihilated, but Khodja managed to escape. The rise of Caye Moyet's government meant the end of Soustelle's tenure as governor general. Robert Lacoste replaced him. Lacoste was a self-described socialist and reformist. His father was shot by the Nazis during World War II. He was determined to change living conditions for the Algerian people, but he was also determined to maintain French domination at all cost, even if it meant defending soldiers accused of heinous forms of torture. Alistair Horn states, quote, Lacoste's most striking innovation was to decree that 50% of all vacancies in public service should be reserved for Muslims, unquote. To be clear, this still meant that Algerians were underrepresented. This undoubtedly would have been a good reform decades previous, but at this point, it was viewed as too little, too late. Ben Bella was still traveling, constantly evading French spies and assassins. He was in Morocco in October of 1956, where he planned to travel to Majorca and then to Tunisia, which had become the FLN's home away from home. Unfortunately, the French had gotten wind of Bella's plans. French military intelligence got in contact with the pilot of the plane, who happened to be a French army reservist, and convinced him to touch down in Algiers as opposed to Tunis. To this day, it's unclear how involved the French government was, and this may have been one of the first of many instances in which the French army acted on its own initiative. The quote-unquote operation went off without a hitch, and Ben Bella, alongside four other FLN leaders, were arrested and detained by the French for the next 5.5 years of war. This was a flagrant breach of international law, as they kidnapped Bella. But unsurprisingly, this action was praised by the press. Across the globe, autumn of 1956 was tumultuous. In America, it was the height of election season. In the Soviet bloc, protests against Russian domination would soon explode into chaos and violence in Hungary. In Latin America, the Cuban Revolution was in full swing. In North Africa, tensions between Nasser, the UK, France, and Israel would explode into a three-nation invasion of Egypt. The Suez Crisis began after Nasser unilaterally nationalized the Suez Canal Company ensuring its profits would go to the Egyptian people as opposed to foreign investors. Despite Nasser promising to compensate France and Great Britain, both powers were more interested in asserting themselves on the world stage, while America and the Soviet Union were preoccupied. Additionally, France was perturbed by deliveries of Egyptian arms to Algerian rebels, as it pointed to a larger pan-Arab movement, which would be more difficult to suppress. The British RAF was sent in to bombard Egyptian positions, and a naval landing was successfully executed on the western side of the Suez Canal, while the eastern side was occupied by Israel. For 2 days, French and British troops fought Egyptian forces. Their objective was Cairo, but diplomatic pressure from the east and west forced British Prime Minister Anthony Eden to accept a ceasefire. Nasser had his nose bloodied, but he became a hero to Muslim people across the globe, who saw him as an underdog who took on 3 European countries for the sake of his own nation. In total, thousands of Egyptian soldiers died fighting against the combined assault, while over 200 Israeli, 22 British, and 10 French soldiers were killed. The Suez War proved that France and Great Britain were no longer world powers. The war, while short, had global ramifications. The conflict pushed Israel inexorably into the orbit of the United States. Uncle Sam was cast as the peacekeeper of the Middle East for the first of many, 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 many times. In Algeria and throughout the Muslim community, the Suez War allowed Nasser to bolster his standing. The Algerian cause had inertia, and diplomatic efforts were beginning to bear fruit. The Algerian cause needed this artificial boost. 1956 and 57 would be some of the hardest years for Algerians. French troops, American helicopters, and new anti-guerrilla tactics were employed to try to stop the revolution. The cumbersome French armies of 1954 were a thing of the past. They were replaced with lightning offensives, which utilized American technology. French reinforcements included elite paratrooper regiments, as well as the French Foreign Legion. The Legion was mostly composed of ex-Nazi soldiers who were unable to serve in the disbanded West/East German armies. Both of these forces were run like fiefdoms. In December of 1956, Raoul Salon arrived in Algeria to take command of the French army. Salon was probably the most decorated and experienced French officer of his generation. He fought as a private on the Western Front in World War I. In the interwar years, he fought against Bedouin troops in Syria. In World War II, he was stationed near the Somme River at the head of a battalion of West African soldiers. Following France's capitulation, he served the Vichy regime, but then switched allegiance to Free France. He was part of Operation Dragoon, which liberated southern France from Nazi control. Salon ended his service in World War II as a general. Previous to his occupation of Algeria, he oversaw the French humiliation in Indochina. All of this had shaped Salon. He never wanted to be humiliated again, and he would go to absurd lengths to prevent another martial catastrophe on his watch. Today, Salon is admired by the far right as someone who, quote, stood up to liberal government, unquote, laws be damned. However, when he first arrived in Algeria, he was viewed as another loyal lapdog of the French government. He was so hated that a secret organization of ultra-pied noirs attempted to kill Salon in his office with twin bazookas, which were fired off from an adjoining roof. Salon was away at the time. The sole casualty was a French officer, who was wounded in the blasts. Several people were charged with firing the bazookas and with conspiracy. Those responsible, however, would never receive significant jail time. One suspect fled to Francoist Spain, and 2 others would be liberated by right-wing mobs during the infamous Barricades Week. One of the major changes implemented by Salon and the new French officials in charge of Algeria was the introduction of Harki regiments. These were regiments composed almost entirely of Muslim Algerians who remained loyal to France. They were to function as scouts and neighborhood defense militias. They even donned FLN disguises to launch false flag attacks. At the end of hostilities, there were tens of thousands of Harkis. They would be abandoned by France, and many were forced to fend for themselves in a new, hostile country. Force K was a name given to one such bungled Harki operation. The French believed they could manipulate a supposed Kabylia separatist group. However, this group, which was given the moniker Force K, was actually composed of dedicated FLN Kabylis, who feigned allegiance to France. Announcing their true colors, they ambushed a French column in the hills, and then sent the following letter to the Governor General. Quote, "Monsieur le Ministre, with the affair K, you thought you were introducing a Trojan horse into the heart of the Algerian resistance. You were deceived. Those whom you took for traitors to the Algerian nation were pure patriots. We thank you for having procured us arms that will help us to liberate our country." Unquote. The Battle of Algiers began in January of 1957. Sadi Yassif was the man in charge of the rebels in the city. Following the execution of two FLN members, mass reprisals against European civilians commenced. Pied Noir ultras responded by planting a bomb in the middle of the Algiers Casbah and killing 70 innocent Algerians. It was only after this incident that the FLN began targeting people with their bombings, as opposed to French property. Yassif's organization was 1,400 strong. In the densely populated Casbah, secret passageways were constructed so that Yassif and his agents could travel inconspicuously. Amongst Yassif's agents were the three women mentioned at the start of the episode. They all de-veiled and dressed in the latest Parisian fashions. All three had no problem getting past French guards, who were more concerned with flirting than checking them for explosives. Zora Drift's target was a local milk bar. That Sunday, it was packed with mothers and their young children. And for a moment, Zora wavered. Sami Lakhdari's target was a popular cafeteria, where many young couples were dancing their Sunday away. Jamila Buhayred's target was an Air France airport terminal. Her bomb failed to explode, but the other two exploded within a few minutes of one another. The first to go off was the bomb placed at the milk bar. It shattered a heavy glass mirror on the bar's wall, sending splinters of glass in all directions. In total, three people died as a result of the two bombs, and another 50 were severely wounded. The twin bombings were deeply frightening to the Europeans in Algiers, who had assumed the rebellion was a far-off thing occurring in the trackless Algerian desert. They lived in a bubble, never imagining the war would be brought directly to their doorsteps. In order to accelerate tension in the city, Yassif planned the assassination of the mayor of Boufarik, Amedi Froger. Ali Lapointe, a revolutionary, was chosen as the button man. On December 28, 1956, Mayor Froger was leaving his home when he was confronted by Lapointe, who fired three shots at him at point-blank range, killing the mayor instantly. The next day, the Pied Noir community all came out to carry the mayor to his final resting place. Lapointe had planted a bomb inside the cemetery and had timed it to arrive with the mayor's remains. The large crowd which accompanied the mayor's body delayed the procession from arriving on time. The would-be bombing incensed the already angry crowd, and they began what they called a ratonnade, or a rat hunt. Several innocent Algerians were beaten and lynched in the streets. In total, four were killed by the mob, and another 50 were injured. General Jacques Salan was brought in to restore law and order. He was a veteran of World War II and the current leader of an elite paratrooper unit. He was given full authority over Algiers. His sole objective was to end the rebellion in the city by any and all means. As 1957 began, the FLN made their first great mistake of the war. On January 28th, they declared a general strike in the city of Algiers. It was designed by Ben Mehdi as a way of inculcating solidarity into the ranks of the Algerians. But the new French military administration seized upon the strike as a means of completely cracking down on any Algerian dissent. The strike was intended to last for 8 days. Instead, it barely lasted 48 hours. French soldiers went shop to shop and forced businesses open. In one instance, a tank shell was fired into the shop of a striking Algerian, simply to end their show of solidarity. French officers looted Algerian businesses during these 2 days. The shop owners and their employees were collected with army trucks and simply forced to go back to work. The next day, the same tactics were employed again, and the general strike collapsed under the sheer weight of state-sanctioned violence. The FLN responded by ramping up bombing attacks against civilians. Yassif gained the allegiance of two women, Danielle Mine and Jamila Bouaza, who acted as the bomb carriers. They targeted two locations, the Automatique, a student hangout, and the cafeteria, which had been previously bombed. The bomb in the Automatique, placed in the woman's bathroom by Mine, seriously hurt several people. The bomb in the cafeteria exploded under a cast iron table and cut down onlookers who were reacting to the bombing of the Automatique. In total, 5 were killed and another 60 were wounded. 2 weeks later, another group of women planted bombs in Algiers Stadium, killing 10 and wounding 45. Following these bombings, a survivor revealed to investigators that he was sure a woman was responsible for the bombings. Up to this point, invasive searches of women were incredibly rare, but with this new information, French security forces began routine searches of both men and women who were coming in and out of the Casbah. Next, and more crucially, French intelligence gained several leads, which led to the capture of Yassif's safe house. Dozens of kilos of explosives and thousands of detonators were seized. FLN leaders in the Algiers area reconvened and decided the best course of action was to break up their resistance. Amongst those leaders was Ben Mehdi, an ex-comedian. Mehdi was one of the more politically minded members of the FLN, and that made him incredibly dangerous to French officials. Acting on a tip, French authorities tracked down and arrested Mehdi in late February. On March 6th, French authorities claimed that Ben Mehdi hung himself while in his cell. Did Ben Mehdi kill himself? Probably not. In fact, several French officials attest to the fact that Mehdi was shot by French soldiers after being interrogated and likely tortured. Of the original Nuits Historiques, only Belkacem Krim was both alive and free of French custody. Ben Mehdi's death put a spotlight on French interrogation methods with FLN members. In reality, torture, summary execution of prisoners, and numerous other abuses had been practiced by French soldiers and policemen before the start of the 1954 revolution. Torture had supposedly been outlawed in France during the French Revolution of 1798, but this did not stop Frenchmen from committing atrocious acts of violence against innocent Algerian people and their alleged allies, in the hopes of obtaining information. S.E. Al-Jaizairi explains the motive behind torture. Quote, "The French tortured Algerians in their hundreds of thousands. They did it because a culture had been planted since the previous century that turned Algerians into lesser beings. Although the latter showed the French loyalty and service, it barely altered their perception. The war just gave the excuse." Unquote. He continues, quote, "Most of those who tortured were not psychopaths, were never evil, criminal minds. They were just ordinary folks. And when the Catholic Church legitimized the act, torture of suspect Algerians became even a dutiful Christian act. After all, the same trick was used then as today in 2024. use the other side's isolated evil acts to justify your own, even if yours are disproportionate to the ratio of 100 to 1 in scale, intensity, and cruelty. Unquote. In 1956, torture became institutionalized. Pierre-Henri Simon describes the average day in the back rooms of numerous French police stations and intelligence gathering centers. Quote, "The first of the tortures consisted of suspending the two men completely naked by their feet, their hands bound behind their backs, and plunging their heads for a long time into a bucket of water to make them talk. The second torture consisted of suspending them, their hands and feet tied behind their backs, this time with their head upwards. Underneath them was placed a trestle, and they were made to swing, by fist blows, in such a fashion that their sexual parts rubbed against the very sharp, pointed bar of the trestle. The only comment made by the men, turning towards the soldiers present, 'I am ashamed to find myself stark naked in front of you.'" Unquote. French intelligence gatherers were also known for their use of the gegene. This was an army-issued signal magneto, which was fastened to various parts of a suspect's body, usually the penis. Henri Alleg, a Jewish European man, survived the Holocaust, only to be tortured repeatedly by French intelligence in Algeria. He wrote extensively about his experience in a tell-all book. He writes that he was electrocuted repeatedly and that the electric discharge was so intense that it locked his jaw shut for minutes at a time. Next, he describes being water tortured, either by having his head shoved in a bucket of ice water repeatedly or by being waterboarded with a garden hose. French intelligence used the same hose to cause lifelong lesions on Algerian captives by shoving the hose up their rectums. Women were treated despicably. They had glass bottles shoved up their vaginas and were routinely humiliated while in French custody. When these atrocious acts failed to quote-unquote break the suspect, an Algerian-turned-French informant was brought in. Their head was covered with a bag to protect their identity. They made it clear what happened to those who didn't provide enough information. Many thousands simply disappeared or were, quote, shot while trying to escape, unquote. French called this the wood chore, or work in the woods, because they told prisoners to gather firewood, only to shoot them in the back. Maurice Saudin, a comrade of Alleg's, was murdered in this way. His body has never been recovered. Cowardly French officials attempted to blame Tunisia for his disappearance. All of this torture and all of these war crimes were incredibly hypocritical, coming from a France which had suffered vast abuses from both the Nazis and their Vichy puppets. Countless French-Algerian war veterans recognized this too late, refused outright to see the parallels in the first place, or worse, they had no remorse at all. In Algiers, the city was entirely under French control, but French officials still had no clue about the whereabouts of Yassif nor Ali Lapointe. Yassif began his third and final bombing offensive. His most infamous bombing was in the casino, where many young couples were dancing and enjoying their weekend. The string of bombings, which were connected to the casino bombing, killed and maimed dozens of people, and Pied Noir mobs lynched innocent Algerians in retaliation. The police did nothing to stop this. In fact, they cracked down even harder on the Muslim community. French attention was fully on capturing Yassif. A promising lead was the capture of Jamila Bouhaided. She was interrogated and threatened with the guillotine, but she refused to provide the French with any information on Yassif's whereabouts. Germaine Tillion was a committed French socialist who had survived the Ravensbrück concentration camp. She was determined to end the fighting in Algeria, or at least end the killing of civilians. Sadi Yassif joined her on her mission. He had made contact with Tillion in order to convey a possible deal to end the bloodshed. She writes that Yassif was deeply concerned about the human toll his bombings were taking. He wanted it to be known that he did not believe himself to be a criminal, nor an assassin. She wrote, quote, "Very sadly and very firmly, I replied, 'You are assassins.' He was so disconcerted that for a moment he remained without speaking, as if suffocated. Then his eyes filled with tears, and he said to me, 'Yes, Madame Tillion, we are assassins. It's the only way in which we can express ourselves.'" Unquote. Yosif explained that he was at the casino in the aftermath of his bombing, disguised in what was traditionally viewed as women's clothing. He was horrified to discover that one of his, quote, "old football friends," unquote, was one of the Pieds Noirs who was now dead, and the young man's fiancé was now an amputee. Yosif and Tillion spent hours talking. Yosif hoped Tillion would be able to get France to agree to what amounted to a truce, in which Pieds Noirs civilians would no longer be targeted by bombings, and in exchange, France would cease their executions of alleged FLN members. All these negotiations came to nothing, and the French government continued executing Algerians. Yosif continued bombing, but he made a point to avoid killing any Pieds Noirs. Yosif and Ali did not realize it at the time, but they had been infiltrated by French intelligence. It was only a matter of time before Yosif and Ali were neutralized. Yosif was first. He was tracked down to his safe house at 3 Rue Canton. The safe house was stormed, and Yosif barricaded himself in one of the many false walls he had constructed for this purpose. After a standoff, which lasted for several hours and resulted in the wounding of several French soldiers, Yosif surrendered himself to the French, in exchange for the promise of good treatment. Following the war, Yosif became a screenwriter. He wrote the screenplay for the Italian film The Battle for Algiers, in which he plays himself. Ali Lapointe was next. Several days after Yosef's capture, Ali was tracked down to his safe house and cornered, alongside Hasiba Ben Bouali and the 12-year-old Petit Omar. All three refused to leave their hiding places, and the French blew up the building in which they were hiding. This ignited a bomb cache, which demolished several other neighboring houses. The three were dead alongside dozens of people who were viewed by the French as little more than collateral damage. The Battle of Algiers was officially over. Although the French could reasonably claim that they had been victorious, the reality was not so cut and dry. The Battle of Algiers did what years of fighting in the hills and deserts had failed to do. It had internationalized the conflict. Events in Algiers were being covered by the global media, and passive observers now felt the need to choose a side. Overall, 1957 was a disaster for the Algerian Revolution, though glimmers of hope came from elsewhere. FLN losses were enormous. The change in French tactics were clearly taking its toll. French anti-insurgency tactics had forced many Algerian revolutionaries to dissolve their movements and move their operations inside the borders of Tunisia, where they received material aid from the Tunisian government. To counter this, the French began constructing the Maurice Line, which was a massive defensive line that covered most of the border between Algeria and Tunisia. For thousands of miles, barbed wire fences and steel parapets lined this formidable defensive position. Most of the combat between the FLN and the French military would take place here. This dynamic change would bring the revolution to the point of breaking, but it would never extinguish the revolution. When all else failed, France bombed Tunisian villages suspected of harboring FLN militants. Infamously, the Tunisian village of Sakyat was bombed by France, killing 80 people, including an entire classroom of children and their teacher. It brought Tunisia and France to the brink of war and was viewed negatively across the globe. Additionally, the discovery of vast amounts of oil and natural gas in the virtually desolate Algerian Sahara added incentive for the French to maintain their grip on Algeria. Negotiations over the Saharan oil and who controlled it would prevent peace for years. Diplomatically, 1957 was crucial for the war and for Algerian self-determination. Support came from several unlikely places. including the United States. This bridged party lines. Nixon celebrated Tunisian Independence Day from Tunisia's capital, and a young Massachusetts senator, John F. Kennedy, threw his support behind Algerian revolutionaries. He asked President Eisenhower and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, quote, to place the influence of the United States behind efforts to achieve a solution which will recognize the independent personality of Algeria and establish the basis for a settlement interdependent with France and the neighboring nations, unquote. As 1957 came to a close, the two sides were still fighting bitterly for any sort of clear-cut victory, either politically or militarily. The FLN had come to realize that direct confrontation with the French military was pure folly. They had largely pulled back into the borders of Tunisia, while a handful of dedicated and bedraggled guerrillas continued the fight against elite French paratroopers in the hills. Meanwhile, the French, although clearly superior in terms of technological prowess, were feeling the strains of modern war. In particular, a new generation which abhorred violence was beginning to protest against a war which was very clearly taking a heavy human toll. Additionally, the French army in Algeria began to act independent of its orders from Paris. Finally, Charles de Gaulle had returned from his self-imposed exile, bent on changing France into something born of his own vision. In order to hear that story, as well as the conclusion of the war in Algeria, you'll have to tune in to the next and final episode. I Will Burn Them. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm your host, Joseph Pescone. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.